Thank you. Welcome to the Bipartisan Election Advisory Committee. It is recording. It is broadcasting. The world can hear us now. So, and my microphone is now finally come on. So, welcome to the Bipartisan Election Advisory Committee. We have a number of things to discuss in today's meeting, and we will have a few more people joining us. For those wondering where some of our IT people are, the first classified briefing is being held as we speak, and so Trevor Timmons, Rich Schleip are over at the classified briefing on security issues. That's one of the things that we've worked with Homeland Security and what? We're getting a conference call going. So we're pausing for a second while that sets up.
Welcome. Please hold while I confirm your passcode. Thank you. Your passcode is confirmed. When you hear the tone, you will be the second person to join the meeting.
Okay, so we did just set up the conference calling for those who are needing to participate and do that remotely. As I mentioned, we have a couple individuals who will be joining us a little bit later, particularly as we talk about plans for the new HAVA funds. And so we will go ahead and start the meeting. But before we do that, I wanted to go around the room and just do introductions of who is here. So my name is Wayne Williams. I am the Colorado Secretary of State.
Amanda Gonzalez, Executive Director of Colorado Common Cause.
Matt Crane, Arapahoe County Clerk and Recorder.
Jennifer Levin, Disability Law, Colorado.
Karen Goldman, Colorado Municipal League.
Michael Valdez, Special District Association.
Yeah, don't skip over our friend from the media. They get to say, yeah.
Kevin Beatty, camera jockey for Denverite.com.
Pam Anderson, Colorado County Clerks Association.
Esteban Hernandez, I'm a reporter for Denverite.com.
Tim Griesmer with the Secretary of State's office.
Lynn Bartles, Secretary of State.
Gary Zimmerman, Secretary of State's office.
Ben Schlaer, Secretary of State's office.
Melissa Polk, Secretary of State's office.
Stephen Ward with the Secretary of State's office.
And all this is Ben. I'll introduce Harvey Branscombe, who just came in as well.
Okay. Very good. The first item on the agenda is just a review of the 2018 legislative accomplishments. If I can get that up on the screen, that would be really awesome.
Stand by.
I seem to be having a little technical difficulties today. Legislature ended, and there were a number of significant changes in the elections world, and our office worked with a bipartisan coalition of organizations to obtain approval for the needed pieces of legislation. So we will be up soon as to what those are. Okay, very good. Well, okay. Okay, the first of those is the elections cleanup bill. As you can see, this was a very closely divided bill. This was 100-0 when you add the two together. This reflects really what my goal as Secretary of State has been, is to work with folks ahead of time and to try to obtain consensus. Let me hit a few of the important things it does. First, this was really the last phase of Colorado's automatic voter registration program. We had already, through regulation and internal policies, made it so that with the new drive system, Colorado was an automatic voter registration state, with preserving the right for individuals to opt out should they choose to do so. What this did, though, is they made it clear in statute, because this is where I needed some statutory changes, that updates to a driver's license record are deemed to be updates to a voter registration record as well. And so we'd no longer have to get their permission to say, well, you changed this, can we change this one too? So Colorado is now, with this change, we track that driver's license change, whatever it is done. This also made some other changes. That's probably the most substantive one, but I want to hit a few of the others. First, there are a number of clerks that now use automated processes to open and sort ballots. This allows a clerk to submit a plan that preserves secrecy without the need for a secrecy sleeve. And so if the clerk has processes in place where no one can know how a particular person voted, this allows them to submit that plan. That saves significant money and also makes processing of unaffiliated ballots in future years easier to do. It updates several timelines associated with canvassing and certifying the abstract of the vote. A lot of this necessitated by the need to do a statewide risk-limiting audit. It allows more time for training election judges. And one of the things that the statute specifically makes clear is that you can use judges. I had an exception to statute last cycle. Boulder County. We're just having a great time on technical side, apparently. I'm not saying any of it's anybody's fault. I'm just saying it's been an interesting time. So I approved Boulder using Weld County Republican judges last time. We made that change now explicitly in statute. One of the most important and critical things that voters can rely on is that throughout the process, there is a bipartisan team of judges. So it doesn't matter whether the clerk's a Democrat or a Republican, there will be both Democrats and Republicans involved throughout that process, watching each other, ensuring that the rules are followed and the election is conducted fairly. And so we needed to give counties that flexibility in the odd cases where they cannot find enough judges from amongst their own residents. It also updates some outmoded language. There were some changes made when we went to voter service and polling center model in 2013, but some of the statutes were missed when that was done, and so this fixed some of those issues. There's a few more changes in it, but I want to, you'll note there that you've got essentially the leaders of either on the committee, so the committee chairs, Marvel and Foote, and then Fenberg and Neville, two folks from the opposite party in the respective houses. So you've got two Republican sponsors, two Democrat, and appreciate the legislators doing that. The second one, which was slightly more controversial in the House, but still passed the Senate 35-0, is the campaign finance cleanup bill. One of the things triggered by including school boards and financing was the need to file major contributor reports a year before an election, which served no purpose. And so this fixed that issue. There was also an odd provision that said a donor was supposed to file the report. They donated the money under some circumstances, and the recipient was supposed to file. Well, the average donor, the average citizen out there has no idea that what they do might trigger a reporting obligation, and so that got rid of that requirement. It's the committee, it's the candidate that certifies they're familiar with the campaign finance rules, so that eliminated that redundancy. It also modernized the language around paper filing requirements and tracer. So, for example, it doesn't matter when my office closes in terms of when a deadline is because you file online. I would note, by the way, if you're listening and you're a filer, that does not mean you have to wait till 11:58, and there will certainly be no one there to help you should you have a question. It clarifies some certain complaint and procedural issues and the distinction between different types of committees, and places additional safeguards in the law to prevent the political use of public funds. So those are some of the things that were done with respect to the campaign finance cleanup bill. Again, bipartisan sponsorship, passed the House overwhelmingly and the Senate unanimously. Questions about either of those two? Flip on to the next slide. When Colorado got rid of the constitutionally questionable prohibition of ballot selfies, it left open the possibility that someone could use that to sell their vote, to trade their vote for something else of value with elsewhere in the country. And so bill passed to ban vote trading, and again, Senate unanimously, House on a divided vote, but establishes that rule. The fourth item is the heavy lift. This was a constitutional amendment, which meant I need to get 2/3 of the vote. As you can see, the total vote was 98-0. So we achieved the 2/3, but now it must go to a vote of the people. If you look on the right-hand side there, you'll see the way the current language works. So you've got Colorado Court of Appeals, and then if you're in the city and county of Denver, you've got the same questions in Spanish. There are a few other jurisdictions that are like this, but none of the others have the same population and therefore don't have the same number of judges at the trial court level. But you'll see that you repeat the same question in English and Spanish, and the print gets very small. That's the existing constitutional requirement. The proposed constitutional amendment changes that, so you'll ask the question once and then ask individually for each of the judges. And you'll see that not only is the print larger on the right-hand side, but there are two more judges in approximately the same space. That means just generally there's some cost savings. There's less ballot fatigue, so less people dropping off. Fewer ballots that go to multiple pages, which means less chance of someone not casting all of their votes. They would be legally eligible to do so. And then for those who would still do all of this anyways, it makes the print larger so we can read it. So there are a number of reasons for that. It is my hope that the voters will agree, but it is up to the voters at this stage. Those were the major changes that our office initiated with respect to legislation. There were people who said you can't do an elections bill in a elections year, and I think this disproved that fairly conclusively. And I appreciate all of our partners in this process. Next slide, please. There are also some other ones that our office wasn't the lead on, but we worked with folks to do that. So first of those is the voter registration for the criminal justice system. This one we worked to get sponsors to allow this, and then we testified in favor. As many of you may be aware, in Colorado, once you completed your sentence, let me back up, a felon serving a sentence is not eligible to vote. But in Colorado, under long existing law, once you complete your sentence, you're able to re-register and to vote. This bill that we worked with folks to pass allows parolees who are released from incarceration to pre-register to vote, and then sets up a process where they're able to do that, and uses the Department of Corrections to inform them of their ability to complete this part of reintegration of society. The second one, enjoined laws, petition circulators. There have been a series of court decisions over the years that have struck down some of Colorado's restrictions on political circulators. This bill cleaned up the statutory language. It, however, did not clear up the additional statutory language now needed by the decision that petition circulators for candidates also cannot be required to be a resident of the state. But it did strike down, or did remove, that unconstitutional language with respect to initiative petition circulators. That passed. Next one, please. Special district elections. As Mr. Valdez is well aware of, there were a number of special district elections held in even-numbered years. With the addition of a presidential primary, this would have created an almost impossible situation to conduct elections. You cannot do a presidential primary and then special district elections and then the regular primary all in the space of a couple months with the overlap and other things going on. And so the special districts worked with a number of folks to pass a law that changes it to odd-numbered years beginning in 2023. You may say, why such a long wait? And that's because you had to figure out how an even-numbered term becomes an odd-numbered term. And so that transition year, you had to elect people from the start to a odd-year term. And this law does that. So congratulations, Michael, and thanks for y'all's work on that. Also dealing with special districts, there was a bill passed, and this was probably the most closely divided. In fact, it's the first time I've seen a no vote on these six slides in the Senate. And this one allows special districts to permit non-Colorado residents to vote in certain elections. Let me explain for those who haven't lived Colorado elections in a long time. Usually you have to be a resident to vote. Special districts, that's not the case. Property owners are able to vote in many special district elections. So if you own a vacation home in Durango and you live in Sterling, you can vote. But if you lived in Farmington, a few miles away, you were not eligible to vote because you were a New Mexico resident. This bill allows special districts to make a change and allow them to vote. We worked with the sponsors to include language that requires the individual to certify they meet the other requirements of Colorado voting, citizenship, and the other things like that. Any questions on any of these other bills? Okay, next slide, please. Probably the end. Yep. So that's what we did legislatively. There were other bills that were out there that we provided input on or gave suggestions on, but not ones that we championed. And none of the others made it through with bipartisan support necessary to clear the legislature. So that's what the changes were in Colorado law. A couple of these take place on signature. The governor's already signed, Tim, the campaign finance bill, and we're waiting signature on the others. Is that generally correct? Yeah. Okay. By the way, Tim Griesmer, our legislative director, is here. Congratulations to he and Suzanne Steyert, who handled that, as well as all of our partners in the Clerks Association, Common Cause, and virtually everybody else in the room that helped work on these. And I think we continue to dispel the myth that election issues have to be partisan. And when you see that there was not a single no vote in the Senate on a single one of these bills, yes, you can get things done. And Tim and his team did a great job, so congrats, Tim. Leads us to candidate petition review and associated lawsuits. Is Ben talking about this one?
Sure.
Good. They can hear a variety.
I'm a little bummed out that the secretary would make me relive the traumatic experience that was the candidate petition 2018 cycle, but we'll get through it. Steve, you can pop to the next one. So first, let's talk a little bit about what was new in 2018 versus prior years. The first thing is that in 2017, the legislature passed a law requiring that the Secretary of State's office conduct signature verification on candidate petitions, meaning that in addition to reviewing the basic information, name, address, et cetera, to make sure that the person who filled out the information was a registered voter and eligible, we also had to review the signature and compare it with the signature that was in the statewide voter registration database to determine whether those signatures matched before we could accept that signature as a valid signature on the petition. We'll talk a little bit about the new software here in a second that kind of allowed us to facilitate that process. In addition to that, and also during the 2017 legislative session, the legislature changed the period of time in which partisan candidates circulate their petitions. In 2016, the law as it was the first Monday in February, so February 1st to April 4th was the period of time that candidates could circulate. What we found in 2016 and in years before that is that pushed us right up against the ballot certification deadline. Once we had done our job of reviewing petitions for sufficiency, we went to the legislature and asked for some more time, both because of what we'd experienced in the past and because we, you know, anticipated that there would be additional petitions in 2018, and there certainly were. So the period of circulation went moved back a couple weeks. January 16th to March 20th was that period of time. We ended up getting so many petitions that we were still, you know, kind of right there at the – go ahead, Secretary Williams.
I was going to add, the original bill, as some of you are aware, that we proposed actually moved it a couple weeks earlier. The legislature modified that, and we said, we think we can still get it done, but it doesn't leave much time for litigation. That's the precursor to what Ben's about to say.
Right, which, yeah, so we got sued a lot, and we'll get to that slide in like three. Although statistically less than in years past, and I have a slide on that too. It just makes us feel better about ourselves. The January 16th to March 20th, that was very helpful to our office because of signature verification being a new component. It also changed a little bit, I think, the calculation that candidates were making as to whether or not they were going to start a petition before going to assembly and things like that. And so that might explain a little bit of the next slide once we get to it of, you know, how many folks turned in petitions and how many withdrew them and things like that. Finally, we in order to comply with the new signature verification law, we implemented a new signature review software. Which essentially allowed us to scan all of the information on each petition that was coming in so that the folks who were reviewing it had that information right in front of them rather than thumbing through page after page after page, allowed them to review the signature that was on the page of the petition right next to the most recent signature in SCORE in the statewide voter registration database. And so our implementation of that new software was certainly necessary in order for us to get done the work that was required by the workload of the many petitions. Steve, you can go on to the next slide. So just a comparison between 2016 and 2000—Matt.
Matt Crane, Arapahoe County Clerk. I'm curious, do you know how many signatures were rejected as discrepant as a part of this process?
I don't know the percentage, but I would say that the percentage was equally low as it relates to well, I won't say equally. I think it was probably closer to somewhere in the 5% neighborhood versus what is lower in the mail ballot realm. Still a fairly small number. Went through the same process, bipartisan review, in order to finally reject a signature, and then proponents had a cure period. Although I will say that, you know, curing a signature on a petition is a little bit more difficult than, you know, the clerk being able to get directly in touch with the voter, but that was available under the statute. So in 2016, we had 20 petitions filed with our office, and these are statewide petitions, right, or for offices of state concern, any statewide office plus House district, Senate district, district attorney, and those types of things. We deemed 11 petitions sufficient, 7 insufficient, and 2 folks withdrew. We more than doubled that number in 2018, and although we had given ourselves 2 additional weeks, or the legislature gave us 2 additional weeks to review, we got more than double, plus we were required to do signature verification. So it was quite a lift for our ballot access team and the folks that they work with to get that work done. 30 were deemed sufficient, 4 insufficient, and then 12 withdrew. That 12 number being fairly high because you had some folks who had originally gone down the petition route and then eventually decided to go assembly. And so they were able to... even though they may have had a sufficient petition, they were able to withdraw their petitions before we finished our review, which was just from an administrative standpoint, was helpful to us just because of the sheer number of petitions. So that's kind of your numbers. Steve, you can go on to the next one. We then, as is always the case in April, started to see the legal challenges, both from a folks who were deemed insufficient, and then also this year, which is a little bit newer than in years past, folks who were kind of coming into the fray to ask a court to declare insufficient for one reason or another petitions that we had declared sufficient. The first set of challenges I call the substantial compliance cases. These are usually the ones where we've deemed the candidate insufficient at the Secretary of State's office, and then they come into court to bring in more signatures. And so I've put up here on this slide the kind of shortened version of what we call the substantial compliance standard that comes from the Colorado Supreme Court. We have an interesting, and the counties face this too in Colorado, we have an interesting law where the Secretary of State's office or the designated election official reviewing petitions is required to apply strict compliance, right? So you are registered to vote in Congressional District 5. You're eligible to vote for the candidate you want to vote for. So if you sign Doug Lamborn's petition and you're registered, and the only thing that you do wrong on the petition is put your P.O. box down instead of your residence address, even though we can find you in the voter registration database, because we apply strict compliance, that doesn't match with the language in the statute, and so we're required to reject that signature. The courts apply a much more loose standard, substantial compliance, which relies on essentially the court reviewing the extent of usually the plaintiff's noncompliance with the law, the purpose of the provision that the plaintiff didn't comply with, and whether there was a good faith effort to comply with the law or whether, the court has found some sort of, willful disregard of the law. If the court essentially finds that the plaintiff has met those three standards, things like missing signature date, P.O. box instead of residence address, and those types of things, those come back in and are then, the court will say, and often does say, and did in every single case in 2018 say, the Secretary of State's office did its job, did what it was supposed to do, but under the substantial compliance standard that the court is allowed to apply, here this chunk of signatures are now considered valid, and so that's going to get the candidate over the line. So Doug Robinson, Republican candidate for governor, and Brian Watson, Republican candidate for treasurer, both came into court after we had declared them insufficient by a very small number for each of them in one or another congressional district. They came in, and what we often do with candidates in that case, because we know where the court's going to go once it hits that substantial compliance standard, we work with them to identify the universe of signatures that we would consider properly rejected by us, but that a court might determine is substantial compliance. We worked with both of those campaigns to determine that universe so that they could go into court, agree with us that we properly rejected the signatures during our review, but also that we take a step back and let the court determine substantial compliance. So for Robinson and Watson, that's what we did, and the court at the end of the day declared both of those candidates sufficient. Polly Lawrence, candidate for also Republican candidate for treasurer, was deemed sufficient by our office. Hers was an interesting case where individuals brought a protest saying that she should not be on the ballot, even though we had already declared her sufficient to be on the ballot. She also brought a challenge claiming that we had that we should have accepted signatures, or at least under substantial compliance, that there were more signatures that she was entitled to. And then Brad Levin, who is the Democratic candidate for attorney general, brought a substantial compliance case alleging that essentially that we needed to add more signatures. Polly Lawrence was finally found to be eligible for the ballot, both under substantial compliance and under the constitutional questions that I'll get to in just a second. And then Mr. Levin was found to have not met substantial compliance, and he was left off the ballot. So one more. Go ahead, Secretary Williams.
Every year we look at how can we make the process better. One of the other changes that we didn't mention is from last year, we obtained permission from the legislature to allow a candidate to cure affidavit issues. Courts had always let candidates cure them on a substantial compliance standard, and we said, hey, why don't we set it up early in the process so that if their notary forgot a date on one of the 32 pages they turned in, they can go back and fix that. So we eliminated that category of needless lawsuits. Going forward, there are several things that I think this body and the legislature may want to look at. And
are you addressing that elsewhere? Can I?
No, go ahead.
Okay. First, clarification on how a protest works. So Polly Lawrence felt like she had to, because there was an attack against her sufficiency, she felt like she had to challenge preemptively over the possibility there might be an attack. So just clarifying that you don't have to do that, because otherwise you could have every single candidate feeling like they need to challenge every single thing, that you have that matter as of right. If someone challenges yours, you have the ability at that point to step in and argue some other ones should have been counted. Because otherwise you wind up with everyone having to preemptively challenge, and I really don't want that to be our standard. There was also, and Ben mentioned this, an order of process. So in the past, for many candidates, there was the opportunity to go to the assembly, see if they got the 30%, and if not, then petition on. In some cases, it wasn't much of a right. So I remember a call from Rod Bockenfeld 2 years ago saying, I got 29.5%. And, well, yes, you can turn in. Yes, Monday is the petition deadline. The assembly was Saturday. You technically have a day to get 1,000 signatures, and we would work to get your petition approved so you could do that. But with moving the petition deadline earlier in the cycle, that ability essentially has gone away. And so I think that's a large policy discussion that we'll want to look at going forward to say, should that deadline, should the caucuses be adjusted to fit the petition process? And that'll be a discussion. The last one is kind of my outside-the-box thought on some of these where we know it actually is the person who signed it. They just didn't technically comply, like they put their P.O. box down instead of a street address. Having a process where because it's actually the circulator's fault, because they were supposed to be checking this as they signed, to rather than require a legal process to allow them to pay a penalty similar to campaign finance or something like that for each violation, and then allow them to cure those and have those be counted without the need for court action. So that's this is not a final proposal. This is just trying to think outside the box of how do we avoid, how do we incentivize people to do it right, and at the same time not have to go to court on things we know the court's going to allow in anyways, and that might be a way to do it. So I throw that out not for discussion now, but just as things to think about, and we'll talk about that in future times.
And the only other thing that I'll add on the last point that Secretary Williams made with regard to people making minor mistakes on a petition, what we never had in the past that we have now is signature verification. And so if you can verify a signature and they match, you know, the fact that that person left off, you know, their apartment number or something like that becomes less of an issue of determining whether or not that's the person who signed the petition. Steve, can we go to the next? Clerk Crane.
Just a quick question. You know, obviously substantial compliance is a very subjective term. Do you have a sense, because I get this question a lot too from folks in Arapahoe County when they see, you know, there's a signature line that people have to get to, and if you either get there or you don't. So in all the work that you have done over your time here at the Secretary's office, do you have any sense of what substantial compliance means? Is it you're within 10?
And I realize it's never going to be an exact answer, but do you have a, like a gut feel if it's at a certain point, Mr. Secretary, if you know? Because I get asked, I'm sure you guys get that asked that question all the time too.
It's not a question of number, it's a question of basis. So let me hit a couple of the major ones, and Ben can then amplify it. So I'll take the first stab, and he'll have more detail. So the simple ones, mailing address instead of a street address. Leaving off a minor part of the address, putting road instead of street, putting, forgetting the apartment number. Those are things that courts have generally allowed. An unusual nickname are things that courts have allowed. So where someone signs it Bud, because that's what they go by, and we can verify, yes, that's X, but that's not how they're registered. That's not what was on the written record. But where the signatures match, those are amongst the most common. You then get into the lived within the district, signed at a different address also within the district. They moved, but they didn't update their voter registration. I know that shocks some people to find out that's not the first thing people do. And so the courts have generally said it is, where it was before they lived in the district, after they lived in the district, they just have moved. Those are the ones that are fairly, that our office has not contested saying, hey, it sounds like this is the actual person. You then get into the odder ones where one of either the registration address or the signature address is outside the district. And in the Watson case, the court allowed ones who had moved into the district, presumably, to count, and the court presumed the person knew what their address was and that they had moved, they just hadn't updated. So there's some broad categories of things that we have tracked over the years, and we can tell you that you can get there. Now, Robinson was, I think, 19 away or 20 away. Watson was over 100 away in a district, but still was able to make it. But his was perhaps pushing the edge. But it's not a hard number. It's what are the circumstances of the people. And so if you were in, let me pick the third congressional district, where you don't have people moving across all the lines and everything else, because you tend not to, it's not as transient as the Denver metro area is between its congressional districts. You would have had less of those moves, and you might not have been able to get there in the same fashion. Ben?
Well, I think the Secretary has identified the categories very well, and I agree that it's not about a number. Like, what we always do in these cases is, and what we've seen successful, is that the plaintiff, well, usually the plaintiff, the person bringing the protest, it's their burden, and they're required to at least articulate to the court, here are the number of signatures at play, and this gets us over the line, right? So then never will the court say, well, you got close, and so we'll let you on, or at least not in my experience, they haven't done that at the state level. But in addition to substantial compliance, that case that was cited on the last slide basically says that courts have to liberally construe all of Title I in order to essentially, fall in the favor of both voting and ballot access. And so I think what we've always seen is courts being more readily willing, like Secretary Williams said in the case of Watson, where you've got someone who is registered to vote today in Congressional District 3, has never been registered to vote in Congressional District 2, but put down on their petition a Congressional District 2 address. And despite having never registered there, the court said, well, I'm going to presume that because that was the most recent address they put down, that must be where they live. I mean, they're going pretty darn far when it comes to substantial compliance. And so I think that when we craft, or when we look at crafting, what is it, how far are we willing to take something like that if we have the person's signature? We'll have to think about what the courts have done, and they've gone pretty far. And then when you have candidates, we had the one candidate who was left off the ballot this year, the attorney general candidate, who just wasn't even in the ballpark. I think was, you know, you need 1,500 in each congressional district, and in Congressional District 7, I think he had somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 valid signatures. At that point, we can't work with you, right? We can't even say to the court, yeah, we took a second look, right? Because that would, you know, we had some late nights, but that would have taken us a month to figure that out. So I think that's kind of the way that the courts look at it. If you're close, if we can get you there, we're going to get you there. Otherwise, you know, you're out of luck. But that brings us to the second set or the second avenue that folks went down to challenge, which is the constitutional challenges. And one of those was successful this year. Congressman Lamborn was originally declared insufficient by the Colorado Supreme Court. So our office, sorry, I missed a step there, Secretary Williams. Our office declared Congressman Lamborn sufficient. Some folks brought a protest against him in state court. That protest at the district court level, the court found that Mr. Lamborn remained sufficient. The protesters appealed that to the Supreme Court, who found that there was a particular circulator who circulated several petitions, who in the Supreme Court's mind did not meet the residency requirements under Colorado law in order to be registered and affiliated. So because the court invalidated that particular circulator, it invalidated Mr. Lamborn's petition and declared that that the Secretary of State was not allowed to put him on the ballot. Mr. Lamborn then brought a subsequent lawsuit in federal court challenging the constitutionality of the first provision that I have quoted here. The most important component of that would be that you must be a resident of the state of Colorado in order to circulate a petition. And the federal district court found that that provision was unconstitutional. That court's reasoning was essentially based on prior litigation, a 10th Circuit case where the 10th Circuit had found that the residency requirement for circulators of initiative petitions was unconstitutional. And so the court essentially followed its own reasoning because it was also the court in that case that followed its own reasoning and found this provision unconstitutional and enjoined the Secretary from enforcing that provision and put Mr. Lamborn on the ballot. Polly Lawrence was also in that same boat in that she had that same circulator who had been declared unable to circulate, and so that was part of her state case. And when the state court eventually put her on the ballot, he essentially acknowledged the decision of the federal court. Mr. Levin, who is the attorney general candidate who didn't make it, also made those arguments but was eventually unsuccessful because he didn't identify the signatures that could have gotten him to his 1,500 per congressional district. All right, I'm going to quit talking now. I think that's – oh, wait, hold on. No, this is the stats to make us feel better. So we had 20 total candidate petitions in 2016. Of those 20, three candidate petitions required litigation, which is a 15% of all petitions. And in 2018, out of our 46, only five required litigation, even though there were about, you know, 28 separate lawsuits out of those five candidates. So it depends on how you look at it, but, you know, it makes us feel a little better.
Ben, thanks. Let me note a couple other quick things on that. This, the Supreme Court decision striking down the residency of Mr. Tipple initially had some troubling language in it for other purposes. They said his stated intent to live in Colorado in the future is relevant only if he has a fixed habitation in Colorado to which he presently intends to return. Why is that problematic? Why is that troublesome? Well, because there are lots of people who have left the state on a temporary basis who don't own land. And so a Supreme Court requirement that you must own land, otherwise your intent is irrelevant, is, well, first a throwback to the 1850s when I think the last state got rid of that requirement. And second, it's very troubling for, you know, a Peace Corps volunteer, a missionary, someone who leaves home and doesn't own land, but they still think they're a Colorado resident because they're not a resident anywhere else. To a worker who goes and takes a temporary job in the North Dakota oil fields because the oil fields here don't have any jobs. So we worked with the Supreme Court and the Attorney General's office to file a request for clarification, which they did issue. And it says, it now says, with respect to his attempt to establish residency in Colorado. So it's the establishment, you need to be here. Once you establish it, the fact you leave later and you don't own property doesn't disqualify you from voting. We've also have issued or are issuing emergency rules on this just to ensure that voters are not disenfranchised by someone taking the wording of this and applying it beyond really what the Supreme Court intended. And so the other clarification they said the Supreme Court added at the time he, quote, submitted his voter registration, close quote. So they added that part. So once you are a Colorado voter, the fact that you then temporarily leave the state does not strip you of your right to vote simply because you don't own property. And that was a significant clarification. We thought about trying to rush through a last-second legislative bill, but we were able to get the Supreme Court to fix that issue so that we didn't disenfranchise Coloradans who were temporarily away from the state without owning property. So any other questions on the things Ben has discussed or the petition process? I will tell you that we did finish the last of these designations, what, on the Tuesday before ballot cert or the Monday before ballot cert?
It was, I'm not sure, Monday or Tuesday before, yeah.
So we finished it several days before ballot certification. Most of the litigation, for the most part, was able to be resolved, but there were a couple of them that extended on into the next week. The last of them, though, was resolved. That was the Levin case Wednesday night at like 11 o'clock at night. So that was a few days past the ballot certification deadline. The Colorado District Court did extend the deadline for ballot certification. And they extended it till the Wednesday. Well, when the decision's issued at 11 o'clock at night, we certified it the next morning. And that enabled the clerk still to get the ballots out in a timely manner, but it was close. And that's what we told the legislature when they moved the date 2 weeks later than what we said would be ideal. But we were not in this situation, and Ben and his team did a great job, Joel Albin, Jeff Mustin, of ensuring we were able to get this all resolved before military ballots went out. If you remember 2 years ago, military ballots initially went out with the name of Ryan Frazier on them without assurance whether he was actually going to be on the ballot or not. And it was the message to the military voters was, good luck. We hope this works, but remember, he might not really be on the ballot, so we'll send you a different one if it changes. And that's not a good message to send. It's not fair to the candidates, not fair to the voters. And so our team worked very hard to get those decisions out quickly. So with that, any other questions on the petition process? Because I know it was a lot in the news. Okay, let's go then to item three on the agenda, the You Choose campaign. Many of you are aware that for the first time in Colorado history, we've got to do the intro for the cool song here. For the first time in Colorado history, unaffiliated voters are able to cast a vote in the primary without affiliating. So you'll notice there, if you look at Colorado, this beautifully decorated U. And so we've been distributing these around the state. And now we can play the beautiful video here. Can we get more volume? Steve? Provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity, to ordain and establish this constitution for the singing the preamble to the Constitution in beautiful harmony. Tom Downey's three daughters with their painted U. So PowerPoint, if we could. So recognizing that this is a new process, I went to the legislature last fall and asked for their permission. Actually, it was late fall, to spend $900,000 on a public campaign to inform folks. Next slide, please. There are three basic ideas with the You Choose campaign. The first was awareness. Over half of the unaffiliated voters were not aware that they could vote in the primary. Second was to pre-designate. We've had over 40,000 Coloradans make the decision to designate ahead of time which party they want to vote in. Third, this is the message going on now. Do not spoil your ballot. You may only vote in either the Republican or the Democratic primary. You may not vote in both. Please don't vote in both. Please return only one ballot. Next slide. So we worked with Forte Advertising, and they began a You Choose campaign to emphasize that choice happens with you and that you get to make the decisions. This was a primarily digital campaign. So if you're an affiliated voter, you should not have seen these ads. If you did, we wasted our money. They should have only gone generally to unaffiliated voters so that they can be aware of what this is, and digitally you can target them. There are a few people at a digital footprint. To those individuals, we are mailing a oversized postcard so they get some of the information, but not as cool a digital ad. Next slide. So this is the basic message. It's driving people to a site, youchoose.co.gov, which says, choice happens with you. Choose just one. Democratic ballot or Republican ballot. Pick one ballot now. FAQs. Some people are wondering, why do you need to tell people? It will be in the voter instructions. So I will now do the survey I often do at these meetings. How many of you in the last election in which you received a ballot read the voter instructions you were sent? Two. I see two people raising their hands at a meeting that is fairly sophisticated voters, I would argue, because we presume we know how to vote. So we don't need to read the instructions that says, don't use, your pink lip gloss to mark your ballot. Use blue or black ink. It doesn't say. But because we have this wonderful challenge, we are doing a public information campaign to emphasize this point. Next slide. So there's banners ad. This is the one on spoilage. Make sure your vote counts. You can only vote on one ballot. Pick Democrat or Republican. Choice happens with you. Visit youchoose.co.gov to pre-designate your ballot. That part we don't need at this point. Next slide. We've had this giant yellow U that has been in various places. We've got one in the southern Colorado. We've got one in the Denver metro area. We have one on the western slope. Next slide. These are those hand-painted wooden U kits, and we've had some fun ones from various people. And if any of you are interested in one that you would like to share on social media, we have a few available still in our office. So let us know at the end of the meeting if you would like one of these to decorate and to share on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever else. If you're next slide. So that's what we're doing. We've had about 40,000 people so far across the state who have made the choice to pre-designate. That means about 96% of our unaffiliated voters have not made said choice. We are working very hard. I did a League of Women Voters presentation last night, did an interview with a news station last night as well to try to emphasize this point. Our clerks have been doing individual things, and some of them have taken some of the information we did. Boulder County, for example, took kind of that You Choose campaign, stuck their logo on it, mailed it to their voters as well. So we are working hard to get the word out to people. If you vote both ballots, neither vote counts. We've adopted regulations here in the office to clarify that if you send both ballots back, the clerk has to go through a fairly complicated process that involves a bipartisan team looking at the ballots to see if you voted both of them. And if you only voted one, then we will still count the one that was actually voted, and they have to do that in a way that still preserves voter anonymity as to how that voter cast. So you've got three judges involved in the process, and it's fairly lengthy. So to the extent any of you can get out through your networks, we'll be sending out a message to state employees because we've got their email addresses. But if, and like I said, we've done a lot. And a variety of other things to get the word out, and we want to make sure that as many people know as possible that we welcome your participation, but you cannot vote in both parties' primaries. Any questions on the campaign or what we're doing? Okay. It is now 2:30. We're going to take a 5-minute break. We'll come back at 2:35.